Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry, I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
Okay, everyone, we're about to start. Welcome to Serial Killers Anonymous. Do we have any newcomers tonight? Anyone?
Me. I'm new.
And you are? Please, stand up. This is a safe place.
Hi, everyone. My name is Paul Bernardo, and I'm a serial rapist turned serial killer.
Hi, Paul.
Wouldn't it be nice if serial killers followed a protocol similar to an AA meeting, announcing their identity, owning up to their crimes, as opposed to the constant concealment? Sadly, this isn't the case. Serial killers often walk in two worlds, the daylight of society and the darkness of humanity's worst possibilities. They show one face to their community and an entirely different one to their victims.
This is usually why they're able to continue their killing spree undetected. No one suspects they're capable of such atrocities.
He has to be the devil to want to take someone's life.
The minds of serial killers have fascinated us generation after generation. We have a hunger to understand these minds, but it's a hunger that can rarely be satiated. As a people, we need answers, closure. And yet we rarely receive that when it comes to serial killers. And so the vicious cycle continues. They kill and we ponder. They speak and our ears perk. Who are they really, we wonder? And how do they get that way?
I'm a human being, and to say that I'm a dangerous offender and raping and killing and all this stuff is fine. I mean, for publicity, you know, get that, you know, tough on crime, get that bad guy. But when you go to a certain point of mind, it just, I mean, it affects me totally. You know, I made mistakes a long time ago. But don't say that today about me, because then we're lying, and then we got a big problem, because I'm looking at you and you're the bad guys, because I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm telling the truth, and you guys are walking around issuing statements that I lied here, I lied there.
The voice you just heard was that of Paul Kenneth Bernardo, a man who lives in infamy as the Scarborough Rapist. He targeted high school and college girls in Toronto, Canada during the late 1980s and early 90s. It was his volatile relationship with his girlfriend Carla that would help push Paul over the edge. It would cause him to become a serial killer and give birth to the terrifying duo known as the Ken and Barbie Killers. Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and this is Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of the world's most notorious serial killers. This week, we put under the microscope the life and crimes of Paul Bernardo, a Canadian serial rapist and killer responsible for 3 murders and more than 15 sexual assaults. But the number of victims may actually be much higher than that. If you want to listen to any previous episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all on your favorite podcast directory or on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. And don't forget to subscribe. A new episode comes out every Monday. And now, I'd like to bring in my criminal psychology-loving co-host, Vanessa. She'll take us beyond the simple facts of Paul's story and provide us with a psychological perspective. Vanessa will be answering questions I have about the mental makeup of a serial killer, what makes them tick, what molded them, and what their thought process is like, as well as providing other valuable insight. It's important to note that she's not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for the show.
Hi, everyone. Before we get into the details of Paul's many crimes, it's important we investigate his earlier years and look for clues to determining the genesis of the man who would come to be known as the Scarborough Rapist.
Paul Kenneth Bernardo was born August 27, 1964, in Toronto, Ontario. Now, when I think of Canada, the first things that come to mind are maple syrup and the iconic duo Bob and Doug McKenzie from SCTV's comedy sketch Great White North. What doesn't come to mind? A serial rapist and killer with good looks and a winning smile. However, anywhere on Earth has its fair share of unexpected anomalies. Let's talk about this one. Growing up, Paul lived in a wealthy suburban microcosm. As a child, he was charming and well-loved, known for his radiant smile and pronounced dimples. He was a dedicated Boy Scout, but people would later recall that he had an unhealthy urge to start fires when he was only 10 years old. Behind the mask of the carefree adolescent was the knowledge of darker days. And it may have been his dysfunctional home life that helped contribute to the emergence of Canada's most notorious pair of serial killers. That's right, pair. Paul Bernardo may have started his criminal career alone, but it was another deranged mind, his girlfriend Carla Homolka, that helped him become a serial killer. This week, however, we'll mostly be focusing on Paul and his own personal trouble that started it all.
For one, Paul's father was physically and sexually abusive. In 1975, he was charged with child molestation for touching a girl inappropriately. He also sexually abused his own daughter, Paul's sister, Debbie. But there was one event in particular that seemed to mar Paul the most. When Paul was 15 years old, his mother revealed to him a family secret that would have an indelible effect on him.
Sit down, Paul.
Why? Am I in trouble?
No. But there's something you need to know. You're old enough.
What?
Just sit, please. This isn't easy for me.
What is it? You're making me nervous.
After your sister was born, your father and I, we weren't happy. We were having problems. I thought they would pass, but when they didn't, I felt so helpless. I ran into an old friend of mine, an old boyfriend, and we picked up where we left off. Basically, there were still feelings there.
So?
We were together. We slept together.
When you were still with Dad?
Well, that's the thing. He's not your dad.
What? I'm a bastard?
No, Paul.
I guess that makes you a whore.
Paul.
This revelation undoubtedly ruined their relationship. From that moment on, Paul would continually refer to his mother as a whore and treat her with disrespect and resentment.
Ouch.
That was a pretty momentous paradigm shift for him. Could this experience have been the genesis of Paul's violent and negative relationship with women?
Absolutely. The nature of the mother-son relationship is vital in shaping a child and how they will relate to the world in adulthood.
So the reveal of his mother's infidelity, compounded with the fact that the man he thought was his father actually wasn't, created a very deep scar.
Most likely. And perhaps Paul subconsciously believed he could somehow eradicate that scar through the sexual aggression and violence he inflicted on women. But it's important to note that although this event in his adolescence may have contributed to his serial rapist identity, we can't assume it's the only cause. The human psyche is much more complicated than that. But I'm a firm believer that much of the problems in adulthood can be traced back to the events and challenges of an individual's childhood, so it's important to include them in the conversation.
Okay, so if we're looking at Paul's childhood for some indicators of future behavior, there's something we can't overlook. The fact that his father, well, stepfather, sexually abused Paul's sister.
You're right. The dysfunction started at home. It was modeled for Paul. And there are generally two paths that a child will take as a response to something negative they experience. Do the complete opposite, or repeat the cycle.
And in Paul's case, he repeated the cycle.
Exactly. He was aware of the sexual abuse in the house, either consciously or subconsciously, and this knowledge manifested throughout his life in a series of rapes and sexual assaults.
The old adage that evil breeds evil seems extremely appropriate here.
Yes. The other saying to consider is, people who hurt, hurt. Meaning, those who are experiencing deep emotional pain often only know how to express it by hurting others.
That's very interesting. But despite the family dysfunction, Paul went on to graduate from Sir Wilfrid Laurier Collegiate Institute. Right after high school, he got a job with Amway, one of the most famous companies associated with pyramid schemes. Paul bought several books and tapes from the founders and would use them as marketing strategies to pick up girls in bars. By the time he started accounting classes at the University of Toronto at Scarborough, he had already had several girlfriends. But the pattern was, once these women realized he harbored dark sexual fantasies, they started to pull away. Many of his ex-girlfriends accused him of physical abuse, stating that he was dominant and sometimes terrifying. In fact, in 1986, two women got restraining orders against him. This was 1 year before his crime spree would begin. At 23, Paul was a strapping young man. Lean physique, muscular, all-American handsome. In fact, he was like the Zach Morris of Canada. He was living in Scarborough, a suburb of Toronto, Ontario, Canada. The year was 1987. He had recently graduated from the University of Toronto and landed a job at an accounting firm.
Sounds like he was living the dream, right?
Apparently, it wasn't enough. Paul needed something else. At this point, I'd like to warn our listeners that this episode does contain discussions about rape. We continue to advise extreme caution. His first victim was a 21-year-old woman. Paul spotted her sometime in the evening, followed her to her parents' house, and attacked her outside. He raped her in front of the home. Vanessa, can you briefly discuss the basic psychology behind a rape? What drives someone to commit such a vile act?
Well, the most common explanation is that the perpetrator lacks a sense of power. So he must overpower someone or something to receive that emotional, physical, and psychological boost. Men often choose rape for this because their targets are physically weaker. The sexual angle also plays into the power aspect. Women are on the receiving end if we think of the physical logistics. Men are more in the position of power. Or at least that's how it's been perpetuated by society.
Right. Well, following his first rape, Paul didn't waste much time. Just 10 days later, he committed his second rape. This time, he attacked a 19-year-old woman in her backyard. 2 months later, in July, Paul was at it again. He attempted his third rape. But perhaps he was too confident, because this time, the woman fought back. She incurred some heavy bruises and cuts from the attack, but her sheer determination prevented the rape. Paul actually gave up and bolted from the scene. This experience had to have affected him, right? You would think he would back off after realizing he wasn't as powerful as he thought.
Yeah, you'd think. But unfortunately, Paul didn't back off. His failure to secure another rape victim probably did a number on his ego. Not only did he not receive what he desired, but he also had to flee from the crime. His running away from a crime he initiated resembles the actions of a victim, not someone in a position of power.
So a big blow to his self-esteem.
Yes. Now he needed a confidence boost, something to make him feel powerful again. This may explain why his next two crimes were even more depraved.
It's fascinating. You'd think he'd give up, but instead he went for bigger taboos. Those fourth and fifth crimes took place in December of 1987.
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message. And now, back to serial killers.
For his next crime, Paul targeted a much younger victim, a 15-year-old girl.
So now he's gone from rapist to child rapist.
Like you said, more depraved. It was after this assault that the Toronto Police Service issued a warning to women in the Scarborough area to be careful when traveling at night. The women who were believed to be in the most danger? Those traveling by bus. Paul was regularly stalking bus stops and following his victims to secluded areas in their homes. This makes me wonder, why would Paul choose bus stops for his victims?
Usually, a killer's choice of location is a very logical approach. Serial killers often measure the risks against the gains. What this means is they take their time to assess the situation before enacting the crime.
What would Paul be assessing?
Well, if he could get away with it, and if he didn't, would it be worth it? Let's discuss what he would gain. A weak, vulnerable victim, someone to overpower, fulfilling a sexual and psychological urge. What would he risk? Someone seeing him, someone stopping and overpowering him, capture, arrest, prison. So serial killers, the most fervent and methodical predators, will access a given location or situation to determine if it's worth it or not. In Paul's case, he struck when teenagers and young 20-somethings were alone and vulnerable. He did this late at night when people were winding down in their homes or already asleep. He targeted quiet bus stops and residential areas.
When he was less likely to be seen or overpowered.
Exactly. So he stalked his targets, scoped out the locations, and weighed the risks against the gains, all which gave him the green light in his mind to attack.
Now it's important to note that just a couple of months prior to this vicious attack, Paul met someone who would become very pivotal to his criminal trajectory. Her name was Carla Homolka, a 17-year-old blonde beauty. They met at a hotel restaurant and instantly hit it off. However, she was 6 years younger than Paul and still in high school. And boy, was she crazy about Paul. He felt it too. In fact, they couldn't keep their hands off each other. Within a couple of hours of their first meeting, they slept together. Later, friends would refer to them as Ken and Barbie. They were both blonde, tall, and fairly rich. Seemed like a perfect nickname. While their relationship blossomed, Paul continued his secret attacks. His next victim? A 17-year-old girl. But instead of raping her like the others, Paul used a knife to sexually assault the teenager.
Oof, that's a big change in MO.
Why would a killer brutally shift their MO?
Just a second, before we go on, for those unfamiliar with the term MO, it stands for modus operandi, the Latin phrase for mode of operation. We use this term to describe the manner in which a serial rapist or killer carries out his crimes. Now remember that failed rape we mentioned earlier, the time the victim heroically fought back and got away?
Yes.
So events like that can affect the criminal's MO. Paul's failed rape attempt back in July probably did three things. One, it convinced him to target younger victims who were more vulnerable and less capable of fighting back. Two, it made him feel less powerful. So this time, he utilized a weapon for the physical rape as a means of regaining a sense of power. And three, the botched rape probably made him very angry and resentful. So he channeled that energy into a much more violent crime this time around.
That makes sense. It was at this point that authorities began referring to him as the Scarborough Rapist. He had committed enough crimes to gain his first criminal moniker. Now I have to ask, would a name like that make someone like Paul feel good? In other words, would it be validating in some weird way?
Possibly. With Paul specifically, I'm not sure if it appealed to him or not.
He seems to address this idea of serial killer notoriety in his police interview. This is from the same segment as before.
The fact of the matter was, is I didn't pay attention to anything. I didn't watch the news back then. I was too busy doing other things. I didn't pay attention. Like, the profile is a serial killer, pays attention to all the news media, this narcissistic personality, blah, 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 and all that crap.
It's interesting in this case because Paul is almost patronizing authorities and the established profile of a serial killer. He basically admits that he's not like the others. He doesn't care about making the news or becoming famous. So I would have to say, based on what he's saying, the title probably didn't excite him as much as we may think. Another thing we can look at is if he had a signature or not. Did he leave anything at the crime scenes? Did he provide a calling card?
No.
Then, unlike serial killers or rapists who desire that form of celebrity, his need may have been more physical than emotional. He would rather have access to something, in this case, aggressive and violent sex with a powerless victim, than gain attention through the media or otherwise.
That's an interesting distinction.
Or we can listen to what he said in the video and conclude that he's just deluding himself, trying to pretend that the fame doesn't mean anything. It's difficult to tell with this one. It's difficult to know what he really believes deep down, but I'm guessing it was less about social attention and more about physical gratification, which then translated to psychological gratification.
Well, one thing's for sure. He doesn't seem to be owning up to anything.
Right. He's taking the focus off of him and chastising the police for how they mishandled the situation with him. That's quite telling.
What's it tell us?
In his eyes, he can do no wrong.
I see. Well, in May of 1988, Paul was ready to strike again. Hiding under a tree near a bus shelter, he surveyed the area for his next victim. He didn't find one that night. The reason? Someone spotted him. A Metro Toronto investigator.
Hey you, stop!
The officer chased him, but Paul was too fast, and he was able to escape.
The brush with danger didn't seem to deter him. Paul committed three more attacks from May to November.
One of the women prevented her own rape, but incurred two stab wounds in the process. She had to have several stitches in her thigh and buttocks. The authorities had had enough. In November of 1988, Metro Police formed a special task force to find and capture the Scarborough rapist. More than a year later, he still hadn't been found. But things between Paul and his girlfriend Carla had gotten serious. He spent months taking trips driving to visit her in her hometown of St. Catharines, which is nearly an hour and a half from Scarborough. Carla's parents adored him too. They thought he was a great catch, considering his charm and good looks and an accounting degree from the University of Toronto. Little did they know he was no longer working as an accountant, but instead smuggling cigarettes over the Canadian-US border. Oh, and also that he was the rapist authorities were looking for. On Christmas Eve, 1989, Paul and Carla took a romantic trip to Niagara Falls. And it was here that he proposed. Carla gave him an emphatic yes. Her parents were just as thrilled. They were happy to invite him into their family.
Congratulations, you two.
I second that. This is an exciting day for all of us.
Now here's where things get even crazier. Paul finally revealed to Carla some of the details of his sadistic behavior. And instead of fleeing or turning him in, Carla encouraged it.
Oh, that's not okay.
Yeah.
But it is really psychologically interesting. The fact that Carla stuck around despite learning of his dark secrets can suggest a number of things. First, Carla may have been so enamored with Paul that she was willing to overlook his, well, shortcomings. It's nothing new to ignore red flags when you're in the throes of passion. People do it all the time.
Probably why the divorce rate in America is so high.
That's right. But there's also the possibility that Carla didn't see his sadism as a red flag. Instead, she actually liked it about him.
Come again?
There's a psychological phenomenon called hybristophilia. It basically refers to people who are sexually aroused by others who commit cruel and gruesome crimes. Oddly enough, it's more common for women than men. Often, these women desire love from a man who carries out heinous crimes, and believe that in order to receive that love, they need to serve as accomplices in their lover's crimes. The fear is that if they don't, they will lose the person they are so desperate to keep.
That's quite twisted.
It really is. But think about serial killer groupies, women who obsess over serial killers from a distance, sending fan mail and justifying their unspeakable actions. Some have even gone as far as marrying serial killers. A woman by the name of Doreen Leoy married Richard Ramirez, a serial killer known as the Night Stalker. She was a freelance magazine editor who reached out to him after he was arrested, and they tied the knot in the 1990s. She even went on CNN to tell the world she believed he was completely innocent. Several of the Charles Manson clan members also married their admirers in prison. So this is one type of hybristophilia, and it happens more than you would think.
Wow, that's crazy. But I guess if Carla liked that dark aspect of him and encouraged it, Paul probably felt like he had the freedom to do more and more damage, which he would eventually do. But we're not there just yet. We'll get to all that. At this point in time, Paul is still working alone, committing rapes and spending a lot of time with Carla. The year is 1990. Paul has committed five more sexual assaults in the last 2 years. But something was about to happen that would throw a monkey wrench into his pattern of assaults. On May 26th, Paul raped his next victim. But there was something unique about this encounter. The 19-year-old woman got a good look at his face. Before that, victims could only describe him as young and good-looking with light-colored hair. Paul usually attacked his victims from behind. So this may explain why they couldn't get an accurate description. This woman, however, remembered him vividly. This makes me wonder, is it odd that this was the first woman to provide a more detailed description?
Not really. A lot of times, victims of rape are so traumatized by the actual experience that they're unable to process or recall what their attacker looked like.
For those of you keeping track, this was Paul's 15th assault. But this was the first woman to provide physical details of the Scarborough rapist.
That was huge for the investigation.
It was. The woman worked with a composite artist to craft an accurate image.
His hair was a bit longer, sort of disheveled, and pushed to one side.
Which side?
The left. No, the right side.
How's that?
That looks right.
When the sketch was published in newspapers and shown on television, several of Paul's friends were shocked. They were staring at what they believed was an image of their friend.
We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network.
And now, back to our story. Several people called the police tip line to declare that the sketch was a dead ringer for Paul. Authorities eventually brought him in for questioning. He was required to give a DNA sample.
I'm going to swab the inside of your cheek. You ready?
Yeah.
So they collected their samples, and authorities would have their answers shortly, right?
Wrong. The sample was placed on a shelf with hundreds of others that had recently been collected from other possible suspects.
This was a huge mistake for the investigation. Police interviewed Paul for 35 minutes and promptly released him. They had little suspicion of him. They said something to the effect that there's no way such a well-adjusted and intelligent man could commit a crime like that. They basically ignored the fact that multiple people called in saying they believed Paul was the Scarborough rapist. But the police just couldn't even imagine it.
Yeah, they let the suspect go because he seemed nice. And this isn't an uncommon bias. It's the same reason killers like H.H. Holmes and Ted Bundy got away with so much before getting caught. This biased assumption was one of many mistakes they would make regarding Paul Bernardo.
So while the DNA sample of the Scarborough rapist sat on a shelf in some lab, the man behind it all was planning his wedding with his bride-to-be. In the process, Paul spent most of his time with Carla's family and became infatuated with her younger sister, Tammy.
Hey! Watch it! Stop!
She was just 15 years old.
Come on, Carla, get in.
Tammy grew close to Paul as well and began to look up to him like he was her big brother.
What are you doing?
Homework.
What is that? Pre-calculus?
Yes. Ugh. You want to do this for me?
Not really.
Come on. You're an accountant. You love numbers.
Not that much. You want one?
Yeah, right. My mom will be home in a second. If she catches me with a beer, I'm toast.
Then you better drink fast.
But for Paul, it was much different. He didn't see her as a surrogate sibling. He saw her as prey. Paul became so obsessed with Tammy that he made a habit of sneaking into her room at night and watching her sleep while he pleasured himself. His attraction became apparent to Carla.
Why do you watch her like that?
Well, she's so young. So innocent. I like that she isn't damaged goods.
You can't be angry with me because I didn't save myself for you.
Why not? I wish you had.
I didn't even know you when I lost my virginity.
You could have waited instead of just throwing it away on some prick. I wanted to be your first.
Do you want to be hers?
Yes. Sometimes it's all I can think about.
Okay. You can.
She would never go for that. She's your sister.
She doesn't have to go for it. Let me give her to you. It'll be your Christmas present as long as you give me something nice, too.
What are you gonna do?
I'll take care of it. Trust me.
No. I want to know.
You're hurting me.
I thought you liked that.
I do. Look, I'll tell you when I know. But I have to think about it first.
Don't screw it up. You hear me?
Of course, baby.
Wanting to appease him, Carla encouraged him to make his fantasies a reality. She concocted a plan and pitched it to him. She'd invite Tammy to hang out with her and Paul one night. They'd drug her, and Paul would rape her while Carla watched. On Christmas Eve 1990, a year after they got engaged, the two set their plan into motion. After the rest of the family went to bed, Carla and Paul invited Tammy to stay up with them and have a few drinks. A chance to hang out with her cool older sister and soon-to-be brother-in-law? She couldn't pass that up. Tammy agreed. But unbeknownst to Tammy, Carla had crushed some Valium into Tammy's drinks, and it was starting to take effect. So she went to lie down. Please note that what you are about to hear is disturbing and intended for mature listeners only. It wasn't long before Tammy fell asleep in her bed. Paul and Carla entered the room, where Paul began to rape her. Now, keep in mind, this was a terribly bold move considering the rest of the family was still in the house. They could wake up at any moment. Well, after Paul started assaulting Tammy, she began to wake up. So Carla defaulted to Plan B. She grabbed a bottle of halothane she'd stolen from the vet clinic where she worked. Halothane is a potent chemical that is legally supposed to be administered through vaporization only. But Carla doused a rag instead and quickly placed it over her sister's nose and mouth, which knocked out Tammy instantly. Paul continued with the assault, all while Carla videotaped the horrific scene. And then something happened. Tammy began coughing and vomiting, most likely from ingesting too much of the chemical. She eventually choked on her own vomit and died right there in her bedroom. Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka had just committed their first murder.
Killing young Tammy may not have been the intention, but it was the outcome. This moment marked the crossing of a threshold that would take them down a darker and even more grotesque path. It also marked the moment when Paul gained a partner in crime. He would no longer terrorize the streets of suburban Toronto alone. He now had his other half to help him lure victims and carry half the load. With the death of Tammy Homolka, the Ken and Barbie killers were born.
So how did Paul and Carla react to the sudden deadly turn? They weren't expecting someone to die that night. And they weren't alone in that house. Carla's parents and her other sister were asleep in their rooms. So what did Paul and Carla do next?
And I'd like to know how they went from committing manslaughter to becoming serial killers. In order to be deemed a serial killer, one must commit a series of murders.
Right you are. So who would become their other victims? And how? We'll answer these questions and many more next week. And Vanessa, what can we expect from the psychological perspective now that Paul will be committing crimes with his wife, Carla?
One thing we will most certainly talk about next week is the unique aspect of a serial killer duo. For example, how having a partner as opposed to going it alone can affect the nature of a crime. Working with someone in that capacity can involve competition and jealousy, and it can involve a boost in confidence to inflict more damage and escalate the crimes in severity.
Sounds fascinating.
Oh, yes.
Well, folks, thank you for joining us for another episode of Serial Killers. Come back next week for the conclusion of the Paul Bernardo and now Carla Homolka story. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory. Or through our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's P-A-R-C-A-S-T Network. And as always, we thank you for listening. Have a killer week.
Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Jessica Mallow and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Jerry Courtney Austin, Z. Cruz, Wendy McKenzie, Nicholas Massu, and Manu Narayan.